Today is January 29, 2014. This is Desiree Hargis on behalf of the H.J. Lucher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Oral History Project, I am interviewing Wendy Clough over the phone about her experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. Wendy, is it okay if I call you Wendy?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. So can you tell me about where you were born and where you grew up?
Yes, I was born in Los Angeles, California. I have one brother who's 4 years older than me. We're kind of a basic middle-class family. my family moved to the San Jose area in Northern California when I was about three. And in San Jose, when I turned four, was when I started taking tumbling lessons. And, you know, that's kind of basically where I started getting involved in the sport. And my first competition was only in floor exercise when I was, like, about 7 or 8 years old. So, and then in around 1960, I was about 9 or 10 years old. I think I was nine when we moved. We moved back down to the Los Angeles area. So I've been in California my whole life.
Was there a person in your family who first introduced you to sports, maybe?
Yeah, I'd say my mom. She didn't compete in any sports, but she was, in her younger days, she was an avid swimmer, and she had taken a lot of different kinds of dance classes. And so I think she just wanted me to have some of those same experiences. And I just got hooked on the tumbling part and it just took off from there, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
My brother did play some sports when he was younger. He was into Little League baseball. And later on, he was pretty interested in competitive bowling. He never really became a professional, but he went in just like some small competitions in that sport. So he was kind of into that.
Uh-huh. Did you admire any famous athletes?
As a youngster, I don't really think so. I was just really an active kid. I was always outside playing and climbing trees and racing kids on bikes. And I mean, just really active all the time. So it was kind of natural for me to want to be good at whatever I was doing. So when I was in any of my, you know, my tap dancing classes or my tumbling classes, I was just trying to be the best I could be and really, you know, excel in anything. And that, I don't know, that just was a natural thing with me. I didn't want to be second rate. I wanted to be my best.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about your path to the 68 trials.
Okay. Well, like I said, when we moved back to the LA area, I was 9, almost 10, and I wanted to continue my endeavors in the gymnastics area after doing that one competition. So we looked around for places for me to, you know, take classes, and we ended up at Lakewood High School, which is, Lakewood is another city in the LA area. And I got into that organization. They had like recreational classes at the high school. And Bud Marquette, who ended up being my coach, was a teacher at that class. And after a while, he took several of us girls, about 10 or 15 of us girls, out of the class who he thought had potential. And he was trying to form a girls' competitive team. He had competitive coaching experience back in Pennsylvania before he came to California. And he wanted to continue that. And so he started a group of about 15 of us or so And that's how the team that I competed for was started. It was out of that recreation program. And the name of the team was SCATS, which stood for Southern California Acro Team. And so around age 10 is when I started competing in all the events as an all-around competitor. And he was my coach and trained me in everything. Mm-hmm. And so as we started competing locally, then we did well. So then we would move on to the state level and eventually the regional level and the national level. And along the way, since he was not confident in his like ability to teach the dance part of gymnastics, he told us, as many of us as possible, to try to get some ballet training or something. So, you know, I did go ahead and do that. I found a local ballet teacher near where I lived, and she was wonderful, and she had a lot of connections to people in ballet. She had George Balanchine. I don't know if you're familiar with that name, but he was a very famous choreographer, came and taught us a class in our ballet studio one day. And I couldn't believe that that person was actually speaking to us and teaching us. She also had some connections to some junior ballet companies, which tried to recruit me to join their junior ballet company because I was doing really well. I was so strong from doing gymnastics that I did well in ballet, and they wanted me to join the ballet company, but I told them I had to decline because I took ballet to support my gymnastics and not replace it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I was about 13, I think, when that happened. And I was really flattered that they wanted me to join, and I was like all in for it. But then they told me how much time I would have to put in on rehearsals and stuff. And it was one or the other. So I had to make a choice, and I knew what I wanted to do. It wasn't, you know, ballet, it was gymnastics. So I just thanked them and went on my way. But I also learned a lot of the dance portion. My coach gave me like films of other champions to study. And so I learned a lot about the dance that gymnasts use from watching and studying those for hours and hours. And I throughout my career, I composed all of my routines as far as the dance went. No one ever helped me with it, so I just had to learn how to do it myself. And I never thought about that until just recently, and I was thinking, wow, you know, gymnasts today have dance specialists working with them and, you know, a specialist for every event practically. And we just had our coach, and then we were kind of on our own for the dance part. We would help each other and, you know, whatever we could scratch and find to help us with the dance portion, you know, we would get information anywhere for that. Mm-hmm. So it's very different today when the kids train.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have a lot more support on teaching them how to become an elite gymnast these days.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Things have really changed.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it really has changed. But anyway, I competed until I was almost 21 years old. And I was very happy with my gymnastics career. And when I retired from competition, I was really satisfied that I had, you know, done what I considered to be my best. I had hit my peak. I had stayed there a while, and I wanted to bow out gracefully and let somebody else take over, you know?
Yeah.
I was ready to move on to other things in my life. I competed from the time I was 10 until I was 21. I did make, you know, the Mexico Games in 68.
And how old were you then?
I actually had my 17th birthday when I was down there in Mexico.
Okay. Well, let's talk about that a little bit later. So,
okay.
Back to the 68 trials. Were there any problems or challenges? How was the team selected? What was the process there?
The process was, and all of those things have changed so many times. It was pretty consistent until after our games. Then they started changing things. But the trials was held. Actually, my team hosted the trials that Olympic year in Long Beach, where we trained, and we were in, of course, a big arena. But the trials themselves, more or less, they felt like a national competition because all the girls that I saw at the trials were all the girls I'd been competing against for a couple of years in nationals. And so we all knew each other. We're all, you know, I mean, pretty much a lot of us were good friends already. And so it was always a really good experience in those competitions, I felt, because I felt like I was rooting for them, they were rooting for me, and we were, you know, there was a lot of camaraderie already among a lot of us, no matter, I mean, we were from all over the country, but we kept tabs on each other, and, you know, we knew each other's strengths and weaknesses, and, you know, we were just very encouraging to each other, no matter who we were and where we were from, and that made the competition really cool, because it kind of made you feel like, no matter who made the team, everybody was going to be rooting for who was going to go to the games, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I ended up placing ninth at the trials, and they were taking a squad of 12 to training camp. And training camp was going to be held in Lake Tahoe because of the altitude.
Yes.
And so they took all of us, all 12 of us up there, and we started training. And they had us housed at a resort right on the lake, and we worked out at a local high school up there. We had 8-hour workout days. We were in the gym for 8 hours. And, you know, it was tough training in the altitude, but I could tell that we were getting acclimated because, you know, everybody was getting through their workouts a lot easier after a couple of weeks. But we were there for about a month to get acclimated. I think about halfway through that time period, they had to start making cuts off of the squad, and the first cut was going to be 4 people. And I got wind of the idea that I was right on the line of being cut or kept, and I made the first cut. And then at the end of the month of training, they were going to cut one more person. And again, it was me and somebody else. I don't know who the other person was, but one of the coaches on the coaching staff, you know, told me, he said, you know, I spoke up for you when we were talking about who we were going to keep and who we needed to let go. And, you know, he said, I kept telling Muriel, she was our head coach for the team, Muriel Grossfeld. He said, I kept telling her, no, you need to keep Clough in this squad. You need to keep her. So thanks to him, that was Benny Edwards from Louisiana. Thanks to him, I think I made some of those cuts because I was just in the gym working hard every day. And, you know, I mean, they didn't really let us know too much what they were thinking and what they were deciding. They just kept telling us what to work on and how to improve and, excuse me. And, you know, I just kept listening and keeping my nose to the grindstone and just training as hard as I could. I just felt like, you know, this is my one shot. And every minute of every workout, I have to be proving myself to these guys, you know, so that they won't, you know, change their mind about me. And, you know, going in ninth place, I thought, okay, I've got some ground to make up here because they can only take 7 to the games, and only 6 of those 7 actually get to compete, you know? So I knew what I needed to do, and but I really didn't have a clue if I was doing it until we left Lake Tahoe. And then when they made that final cut and it wasn't me, I just breathed a big old sigh of relief thinking, oh, okay, I guess I worked hard enough. You know, I showed them that I was worthy. And after we got to Mexico, then they had to decide who was going to be the seventh person. And at that point, I don't think, at least I didn't get a feeling that I was going to be seventh. I felt pretty confident that, you know, I was going to be on the six-girl squad. So, and that's how it turned out. So I was really thankful for that. But it was kind of nerve-wracking every time they had a cut date coming up, you know. It keeps you on your toes.
Yeah, for sure. So what was the reaction of your family and friends and, you know, people who knew you to finding out that you made the 68 Olympic team?
Well, because my team had hosted the trials, all the people, all the parents and gymnasts from my own gymnastics club were working in the competition, you know, to help run the competition. So my parents were, I mean, they had about as much knowledge about how I was doing as I did. I mean, they knew I placed ninth. They were excited that I was going to training camp, you know. And the thing is they whisked us off that night, on the last night of the competition. They took us to a hotel to process us for like vaccinations and whatever else we needed for traveling, passports and things like that, right away. And then we went straight to Tahoe from there. So from the end of the competition, I never even went home. And they just had to, I don't even remember how we got our clothes to us from there because we had nothing, but they pretty much, I didn't have any time with my family right after the Olympic trials. And the only contact I had with them were phone calls every couple of days. But they were very excited. And in fact, the Olympic trials was the only competition my brother ever came to see me in. Besides the Olympics, he actually made it to that too.
Oh,
with
wow.
My mom and dad. So in all the years that I was in that sport, I mean, he was always busy with what he was doing, you know, and of course in that sport, you have competitions like every weekend during the season, which runs basically from September to June. And, you know, I mean, to him, it was not that exciting sitting around waiting to see me go up for a minute and a half and then sit and wait again, you know. So, but yeah, those were the only two competitions he ever saw me in. But if he was going to see me in anything, I'm glad it was those.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's great that you that your family was able to see you.
Yeah, they were very happy about that. I did get to see them. I think it was like the day before. More or maybe 2 days before the actual competition, we went to the competition venue, the arena, and we got to practice in there ahead of time so that we could kind of get our nerves settled and get a feel for the competition environment ahead of time. And I think it was that day that they found out that our team was going to be there that day. And I remember seeing them outside the venue. And that was the first time that I had actually seen them since the Olympic trials. So that was over a month that it had been since I had seen them. I talked to them on the phone as all between times.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah. It was quite an experience.
Yeah. So as you were preparing to go down to Mexico City, did you remember ever hearing anything about the Olympic Project for Human Rights or possible protests or boycotts?
You know, they really kept us out of a lot of the media at that time. I think because gymnasts tend to be quite young for the most part, and I think possibly because of our age, they kind of sheltered us from a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I think they were thinking also that they were trying to keep us focused. So we didn't hear much, but an interesting thing happened to us gymnasts. When we left Tahoe, they didn't want any of the athletes to go home from wherever they had been training, and they congregated a lot of the athletes in Denver to get on some charter flights for Mexico. And so that took about a day or two in Denver for everybody to get there. So while we were there, we had a little bit of free time one day, and some of us were going to go out and just see a little bit of Denver, just walking around from the hotel. And in the hotel lobby, we saw other Olympic athletes, and some of the guys on the track team saw us with, of course, you know, Olympic uniforms on, and they came over to us and they said, "Who are you? You're so little. You're so cute. You know, who are you?" And they wanted to know everything about us. And so we started talking to them, and they said, "Hey, you know, we're going to go get something to eat. You guys want to come with us? And we're not going to be gone that long." And because we told them we couldn't be gone too long. And they said, "No, we're not going to be gone that long." So we all went together, and we just hung out for a couple of hours. And they just thought we were the greatest thing since pancakes, I think. But they just couldn't get over our size and, you know, the fact that we were Olympic athletes and they were. And, you know, track people are tall, you know, and compared to us, there was a big difference and also a difference in age. And these guys were just fun. They were gentlemen. They were polite. And, you know, they made sure that we got back on time. And they just said, "Okay, we'll see you when we're in Mexico. If you guys see us, you know, make sure you say hi." And we're just saying, "Okay, you know, thanks for the time, you know," and it was fun. And little did we know that we were talking to two of the guys that were going to hold up the Black Power fist on the podium on the award stand, you know. And I can remember when that happened and we heard about it, and I said, I forget who told us, but I said to them, "Who was it that did that?" I said, "Tell me that again." And they told me, and I said, "I'm shocked. I said, I met these guys. I hung out with them for a while. I'm shocked, you know, that they would do that." But, yeah, they did. So I was having a hard time understanding it at the time, you know, but now when I think back on it, I think they must have felt really strongly about whatever it is the message they were trying to send.
Uh-huh.
And with all the political unrest in our country at that time, over a lot of things, you know, I mean, I can understand why they would have strong feelings about that. And, you know, living in L.A., I experienced the Watts riots. I could see the smoke from my house of things burning when they had the riots in Watts. And I do remember that. And I thought about that, you know, and I just felt like, you know, we do come from a country where we do have the right to free speech and expressing our opinions. I just thought that was the wrong time and place to bring it up. You know, I just thought it was in poor taste to represent the rest of us that way, because we all did represent each other. Whether they really thought about that or not, I have no clue. But, you know, it just, after a while, it did disappoint me. Mm-hmm. I can't say I was angry over it, but it was disappointing
mm-hmm.
to me.
Were you there? Like, did you witness their protest on the metal stand, or were you somewhere else?
No, I think I learned about it the next day. What we did was, a lot of times when we were doing things around the Olympic Village, we'd pick up as many newspapers as we could to collect things for our own scrapbooks and stuff. And I think that's how I learned about it. And, you know, I saw pictures in the newspaper and stuff. And even then, you know, I was 16. I didn't really understand the full scope of what was going on, because, you know, I was a teenager. And it wasn't until years later that I really started thinking about that, because people would ask me about it, and every time they'd ask me, I'd think about it more. And, you know, I just came to the conclusion that, you know, people are going to do what they're going to do, and sometimes they do something impulsively and they don't really think it through. And whether these guys actually planned this or didn't, I don't know. Whether it was them that planned to do it, or just at the last minute they said, okay, there's going to be two of you up there, you guys do it, you know. I don't know how all that happened, but I just know that I felt like they were representing an entire country, not just a small sector of the country. And that's how I felt when I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that deserved the respectful behavior that we should have all had, you know. And some of us did, and others chose something different. So, you know, it's
kind
of hard to explain when you don't really get to talk to the person who did it, you know.
Yeah, I can understand that. Did you ever hear anything about violence and student protests in Mexico City about about 10 days before the start of the games?
I think someone, it was either in one of the newspapers or someone said something about it. But again, I think our coaching staff, because I think our competition was not too long after the opening ceremonies, like within a day or two. I think what they really wanted was for us to be really focused. We had a couple of practice sessions before we actually competed, and I think they just didn't want to bring up anything that would cause us to lose our focus. Because we, at training camp, we really pulled together as a group of athletes, and like I said, we all knew each other even before that. So we really were just trying to stay focused. And I personally felt like anything somebody tried to talk to me about that wasn't having to do with, you know, that would distract me, I really didn't want to have to get too involved in it, you know?
Sure.
So, no, I didn't hear a whole lot about it. And it didn't really register with me while I was there.
Sure, that makes sense. What about Mexico City when you first arrived? What were your impressions of the city and its people? And also, since your parents and brother were there, what did they think of the city and the people?
They had a kind of a difficult time being there. They felt like the city was hard to get around, traffic, and, you know, they had to take taxis everywhere, and they felt like it was difficult for them, but they weren't there very long. I had been there once or twice before the games, because my coach had gotten some of us girls in a junior Olympic competition, kind of like a competition that was international, but yet not on an Olympic level. It was just for junior athletes that were excelling and needed some further experience in different kinds of competitions. So I had been in Mexico City once or twice before, and some of the places where we went on those trips were the same places that we ended up going to during the Olympics, too. So I was familiar with some of the main streets and some of the main, like, areas, like, well-known areas of the city.
Mm-hmm.
So I already knew what to expect getting there. And going for the games, it actually took some of the edge off of being in a different place because I had been there already. So that it kind of was a good thing, you know. And I thought, yeah, the traffic in the city was awful, but what big city doesn't have bad traffic, especially during the Olympics, right?
Right.
And as far as us being able to get around to where we needed to go, there weren't any problems. I mean, we had available transportation to get where we needed to be, and it was pretty smooth going for us. So, I don't know. That part for me seemed like it worked well.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of other people had trouble, though.
Yeah, I'm sure. What about the security? What did you think of the security there?
I was pretty impressed with the security at the Olympic Village and the venues. We would see the security people. A lot of them were armed. And that was understandable, in my opinion, anyway. And it made me feel like they did their best to step up and protect everybody who was there, whether it was an athlete or a spectator, you know. And I just felt like, you know, they did their best, and I felt safe. But then I also, like I said, having been there before, I kind of knew what to expect. At that point in my life, I was actually fluent in Spanish, so I felt like if there was a problem, I could speak to somebody in Spanish and, you know, take care of me and whoever was with me. So I don't know. I never felt like I had anything to fear while I was there.
Mm-hmm. What about your accommodations in the Olympic Village? What was that like?
Different. I'm not sure how to say this, but their idea of accommodations were minimal, I guess, compared to what they probably do now for athletes. The high-rise apartment buildings they built for all the athletes to be housed in had cement floors, and I mean, just plain cement. There was no, like, carpet. There was no tile on the floor that I can recall. And that seemed kind of odd to me. And unfortunately, Mexico is not known for having great plumbing, so the shower backed up a lot.
Oh.
And, you know, and we had our squad, so our seven girls and our coaches, our women coaches, and then we were also sharing that apartment with some of the swimmers. So there were about six swimmers in our same apartment with us. So that was interesting because their schedule was a lot different than our schedule. And we had to learn to be respectful of each other's, you know, schedules and what they needed when they were there and what we needed when we were there. And that was pretty interesting. But I mean, it was, you know, it was a place to sleep. It was a place to relax. We didn't do a lot of, like, I would say spend time with a lot of other athletes, too much. We didn't have a lot of downtime. So, whatever downtime we had, we were heading off to get something to eat. And by the time we'd get back, it'd be like lights out pretty soon, you know. And like I said, our competition came up pretty fast, so we were just, you know, attending to our business until all of that was over. But the accommodations, I thought, were okay. And the Olympic Village was, it was easy to get around for us. You could walk to just about anything in there if you needed to, walking to get your food and walk out to the main gate to catch a bus to go somewhere, things like that. There were games and things you could play in the main, like near the main gate, there was like a place where people could play ping pong or other games or watch TV or something like that. So, I don't know.
Sounds like a fun time.
I said, we didn't spend a whole lot of time there, so.
Oh, okay. Well, Wendy, what about the food in the Olympic Village? Do you remember anything about that or whether anyone you know got sick from food or water?
I don't know of anybody who got sick, but I was pretty careful having experience in Mexico before. I never got sick in Mexico, but I was also very careful because I didn't want to get sick. I was down there to compete, and I didn't want anything to mess that up, so I'm kind of a picky eater anyway. I've always have been. So I ate a lot of steak when I was there, and it was good because it was something that was completely cooked. And I thought, okay, this is safe. I kind of stayed away from salads and, you know, things that might make me sick. So bread and steak is basically almost all that I lived on, and maybe scrambled eggs in the morning, and that's about it. Hmm. So... but, you know, I saw other people eating just everything that was there, and I didn't hear about a lot of people getting sick, but that doesn't mean that it didn't happen.
Hmm. What are your strongest memories of the opening ceremony?
Oh, that was the coolest thing. It's kind of, I mean, we didn't exactly know what to expect. And we're, you know, in this huge long line of all these athletes waiting to go in the stadium. And the coolest thing was when we walked in, as we were walking in and starting to go around the track, this wave of people shouting, USA, USA, it followed us all the way around the stadium as we moved. And that was the coolest thing. I never expected that because that place was packed. The rafters, you know, and it was a sea of people. And then, you know, you kind of look around at the floor of the stadium and you see all these people from all these other countries and hear everybody in the stands is, you know, yelling USA. And it was cool. It was very thrilling.
Did you have any really close friends on the team?
Kathy Rigby and I grew up together in the gym, competed, you know, our whole, well, she competed after I retired, but for a little while, but basically our whole competitive career was together. There were a couple of other girls who made the 12-girl squad, and then one who went on to compete with us who were from the state of Washington. And my team went to gymnastics summer camp up in Washington, and we knew those girls from there and a few other girls from Canada. So when we saw them at competition, it was, you know, really fun to see people that we spent, you know, a couple of summers with doing gymnastics at a camp.
Sure.
And, you know, I mean, that was really fun because we knew them from other places. And then here we are competing at the highest level together. And it was very cool.
Yeah.
And like I said, some of the other girls from other places around the country, we had known from just seeing them at different, competitions mainly, but maybe if there was a special workshop by, you know, like a famous coach or something, and we all ended up there together, you know, we'd be out there just learning together and improving ourselves together, you know. So it didn't always feel like, you know, so much like a rivalry when we competed. It was more like we were already all on the same team anyway, and we were just cheering each other on. And then when we got to the games, it was even a stronger feeling of that, you know?
Sure. What about interactions with other national teams? You mentioned Canada, but did you have any interactions with members of Soviet bloc teams, for example?
I would say mostly no. However, in our building, I don't remember what floor we were on, but it was pretty high up. When we would go up and down in the elevators, we would run into people from other places. We did keep seeing a few Chinese girls in the elevator. And every time they'd see us, they'd want to talk to us because we were from the U.S. And, you know, we'd try to talk to them. And, of course, you know, the language barrier was always interesting and fun. but when they saw us, they recognized us after a while, and we recognized them. So even if we would see them walking around someplace else, you know, we'd always wave and say hi. And we couldn't get much more out other than hello. But, you know, we kind of did make a connection there. And I don't even know if they were gymnasts or what sport they did. We never did find out. But they enjoyed meeting us. And I think even after our competition was over, something that athletes do sometimes is they trade uniforms. And so they would see us in part of our uniform, and, you know, they knew the word trade, and they would ask us, you know, trade, you know, we said, yes, you know, we'd tell them, like, you know, in 2 days after our competition or whatever, you know. And so we would make sure to find each other, and then we would trade uniforms. And that was kind of fun because, you know, I mean, they were taking something home from the United States. We were taking something home from China. And, you know, people would ask us when we got home, you know, what's that and why do you have it? You know, so we'd tell them how we got it. And that was cool.
Yeah. But
that was the only, I think that was the only contact with communist athletes that we had.
Mm.
Other than maybe seeing them walking around outside, you know,
mm-hmm.
but that was just passing by.
Yeah. Did you meet, I can't pronounce her last name, but Vera, she was the Czech
gymnast. Vera Seslaska?
Yes.
I did not meet her, but, you know, that was the third time that she won the all-around gold medal in the Olympics. Was at our Olympics, and that was her final Olympics. And after our competition ended, she got married at the games. And we saw her wedding procession drive through the Olympic Village, and we watched it from our apartment out the window. And that was pretty cool because we knew, we had heard and we had seen newspaper articles about her, you know, her plans to marry this guy. I forget what sport her husband did, but he was there too. And they went ahead and had the wedding down there. And, you know, everybody in the village was talking about the procession, you know, that drove through the village. So I thought that was pretty cool that they got to do that and they didn't have to be back in the communist country to do it, you know. I was happy for them that they got to do that.
Mm-hmm. Did you?
But, you know, we competed in different rounds, so we didn't get to see every team that competed unless we had tickets to stay in the stands, but none of us did. So we never even really got to see any of the other teams compete. And her team was not in the same round as we were.
Oh, I see.
You know, it's not quite like that today, I don't think. I think the athletes have more access to stay and watch other athletes compete than we did.
I see. Do you remember anything about drug testing in 68? That was the first year, or one of the first times that they started implementing some type of drug testing at the Olympics. Do you remember anything about that?
Yeah, I do. Not a lot, but I was aware that it was taking place and everybody was tested and they were they would I heard that they if it, somebody was suspected of having anything illegal in their system that they were then questioned and I guess there was further investigation of some kind, but none of us had any problems, so as far as that goes, I just knew what we were hearing about other people, but it wasn't any of us, so. But I was aware that it was going on.
So you didn't have to do any drug test or a urine, like urine, give a urine sample or anything like that.
I don't remember how they tested us. I do know that when we were taken to the hotel after the Olympic trials, they did draw blood from all of us. And I don't know if that was for drug testing. I thought it was, but I'm not 100% sure. So, yeah.
How did you feel about that? About having to have a blood draw right after that?
Well, I didn't have a problem with it. I understood because I had heard about drug testing and we'd already talked about it, with my coach and other gymnasts. And I mean, we all talked about it. The coaches of the coaching staff of the team, said that it was going to be happening too. So we all knew what was going on. And I didn't have a problem with it because I felt like, I mean, the competition had to be as fair as possible. And if that was one way to make sure that the athletes were really doing the right thing, then that was fine with me, I still feel that way today. I mean, with all this stuff going on with professional athletes doing all this stuff, I don't know. I just feel like if you're gonna compete in something like a sport, that you should just do what your body is capable of doing and take the results you get, not enhance it in an artificial way to get better results for whatever your reason is. I don't see the logic in that myself. So I don't know. I mean, that's just me. I mean, I've never taken any kind of drug. I've never even put a cigarette to my lips. So I would never think of doing that. I would never, even if someone offered it to me or snuck it to me somehow, I would refuse it, So I don't see the point in doing that. I mean, I can probably say that maybe some professional athletes would get a lot more money for performing better in their sport. And maybe that's their motivation, but since my sport didn't provide me any money, I didn't see any reason to do any drugs to be better at it,
What about gender verification testing? Do you remember that from the 68 games?
I don't remember that.
Okay.
Was that actually going on?
Yeah, there was a little bit of that. I'm not sure how widespread it was, but they were taking cheek swabs from a lot of the female athletes. I thought it was all of them, but it may not have been. And they had gender testing because of some rumors and some controversies that had happened in sports recently prior to that.
Yeah. Now that you mention that, I seem to recall hearing about that. And it's possible that may have been something they did after we got down there. I really don't remember that though.
Well, any other very memorable or meaningful experiences there? I know you had a birthday there. Do you want to tell me a little bit about that?
We really didn't do a whole lot. They had a cake for me in the apartment after our workout that day, I think, is about all. I mean, it was not a big deal. I'm not a real big, I don't throw big parties for myself for my birthday. I kind of downplay it all the time. But I think it's because it's a summer birthday. I never even had a birthday party at school with my friends or anything. I always had to do it during the summer, and everybody's always off on vacation. So my birthday was never really a very big deal over my life. And I was fine with that. But I learned about something. I'm sure you know this, but our team placed sixth overall as a team. Mm-hmm. And that was the highest finishing place of any U.S. team in history to that point. And a while after I'd been home, there was a publication called Gymnast Magazine that was published in Santa Monica by a friend of ours who had known all of us kids for a lot of years. And somebody wrote an anonymous article to this magazine about me in the Olympics. And somebody gave me a copy of it one time. And unfortunately, with a lot of my other memorabilia that I was storing at somebody's house, it was destroyed. But so I don't have it anymore, but I do know about it. I never found out who wrote this I was trying to find out and I never could find out, but they wrote an article about what I did in the Olympics. And I thought, why would they write about me? Because I was not the star of the Olympic team. There were a couple other people that were the ones that were supposed to be the memorable gymnasts of that team. And I guess somehow I set some sort of unofficial record. The format of our competition in that time period was you had two rounds of initial competition, and you did, there's the four events in gymnastics. You ended up doing two routines on each event, and the rounds were on separate days. So the first round was compulsory exercises, and then the second round was optional exercises where you get to show off your expertise and your best of whatever you can do. So at that time, it was left up to the coaching staff of each nation to decide the order that their team members would compete in. And I guess the strategy for the U.S. squad was to put somebody really solid and reliable up first in the events to kind of set the starting score, because then all of your athletes follow that person. And as soon as all your athletes are done on that event, then you go to the next event and do it all over again. So out of the eight times that we were competing in those two rounds, my coaches put me up first seven times. And by about the fifth time, I was starting to wonder, what are they doing to me? You know, why are they making me go first all every time? And I think I even asked them by about the sixth time. I said, so am I first again? You know, and I don't know, they must have felt sorry for me or something and maybe changed what they were doing, or maybe they decided ahead of time. I don't know. They probably had to know ahead of time, but I ended up going first seven out of eight times, and apparently the record I set was I set the highest starting scores in those seven out of eight times of any gymnast to that point in history for the United States gymnastics, teams.
Wow.
So, yeah. And I had no idea until I read the article. And apparently it's some sort of unofficial record because it was never recorded anywhere other than that article that I know of. And but after I read that, I thought, wow, I did that? And I really had no clue that I had done something like that. But, you know, just in my very quiet, subtle, non-assuming way, I just went out there and I can remember walking up on the podium each time and just telling myself, you know, you got this, you know what you can do. You need to just make sure you do what you can do and don't mess up. And that's what I did. And it ended up being a really good thing for the team because that was the first time that the U.S. ever broke into the top 10 in the Olympics.
Wow.
And we ended up in sixth place. So I've been walking around saying, you know what? I hold an Olympic record. Nobody knows about it, but I know about it. So I just thought that was really cool. And I don't even think my coach really knew about it. I don't know if he ever read that article because it was, I didn't even have the article until after I had finished competing. And I was kind of out of touch with people at that point, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I was coaching myself at that point, but, and I just kind of set the article aside and I thought, okay, you know, this is an anonymous author writing this. I don't know where he got this information. And, you know, I just kind of took it with a grain of salt and I didn't make any big deal out of it until years later, I started thinking about it like, wait a minute, I did that. So I thought that was kind of a cool thing to find out after the fact, you know, because I was just happy that I got to do the Olympics in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought it was such an honor, you know, to represent my country and, you know, do my best. I mean, I hit all of my routines. In fact, our whole team did. And we knew going in that if we all, you know, did what we had practiced, that we could do really well. And what we were hoping for, that at least one of us would make event finals and maybe get close to getting a medal, you know, just one of us.
Mm-hmm.
But for the whole team to come in sixth, we were just ecstatic. I mean, we were just celebrating all over the place for mm-hmm. that, you know. So that was a cool experience. And that happened like years after the competition. So, you know, it keeps on going.
Uh-huh. So why was the U.S. Lagging behind in terms of finishing until 68? Were the other gymnasts really that much better, or was it more of a political thing or a judging thing, or, you know, it was subjective? I don't know. What was the reason, in your opinion?
I think it was a combination of things. I think at the time that my generation of gymnasts were training for those Olympics, I think we were beginning to take the sport a lot more seriously than before. I think in our country, the sport of gymnastics, even though people would spend a lifetime working at it and a lot of hours every week in the gym, we didn't really take it a whole lot more seriously than just a recreational type of thing. You know, it was just, I just think that was the mindset in our country,
mm-hmm.
as far as the gymnasts were concerned, the athletes. And, you know, we would go to competitions and want to do well, but didn't. And it just, you know, I mean, it was just sort of expected that we wouldn't. And I think what turned it around was, it was a combination of, you had a squad of girls on my team that we were dead serious. I mean, and we were looking at the other countries who were always winning, and we were studying them, and we were patterning our mindset after what we thought they were doing. And we went in with a whole new attitude, I think. I think we really did.
Hmm.
And we were we were not looking at just getting to 10th place or 8th place. We were looking at medaling as a team. We really felt we could. And even though we didn't, it didn't matter. We knew we had been successful because no one messed up. Everybody did what we trained to go there and do. And the results were, you know, a huge improvement over what any other U.S. team had done.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just super proud of that. So the other thing that I think contributed before then was judging. I think that the U.S. didn't have as many international judges until that time and since then. And so you can't just, you know, it's a whole ball of wax that you have to put together to be successful. And without judges on the international scene, I don't think that our country really had a whole lot of input into the sport and the development of the sport. You know,
mm-hmm.
I think a lot of that was coming from the communist bloc countries and maybe a few others who had been winning all the competitions up till then.
I see.
And, you know, so it was just more or less, it was kind of like a changing of the guard,
uh-huh.
so to speak. You know, on the judging end and on the coaching end and on the athletes end, everything was starting to shift. And we really did go into that games, at least I think from the athletes aspect anyway, which is really only all I can speak of. But I think we really went in thinking, you know, we have a shot at this. And we were bound and determined to just go for it. And we did.
Mm. Absolutely. That's a great bit of information, definitely. That's really interesting. What about the closing ceremony? Were you there? Did you get to participate at all?
No, didn't get to go. They were only allowing a certain number of athletes from each country to go. And so because of that, then every sport was only allowed a certain number of people. And I don't know how they chose the people from gymnastics, but I wasn't chosen, so I didn't get to go.
Hmm.
So those of us who didn't get to go, we went out and saw Mexico City that day. And we had a great time. They had college students who would drive us anywhere we wanted to go. We just had to tell them what we were interested in doing, and they would take us and stay with us the whole time and make sure we got back. So that's what we did. And we just had a great time. We were done with our competition and totally relaxed and just enjoying every moment we could find
mm-hmm.
by that point.
Where did you go? What were some of the things that you did?
Well, because I had been there before, I told some of the girls were asking about buying jewelry, like turquoise and silver jewelry,
mm-hmm.
which is like a specialty of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew of some places, and I told the guy that was going to drive us, you know, that I knew about this place, but I didn't know exactly how far it was from where we were. But he knew of it, and he said, oh, no problem. I'll take you there. And we said, well, we also would like to go someplace really fun. And we asked them if they had any amusement parks. And he said, yeah, I know a really good one. So he took us there, too. And on the way, he said, well, do you mind if we make a stop at my house? I'd like you to meet my family. So we said, sure, no problem. You've been driving us around all day, so yeah, we'll do that. So we stopped at his house, and, you know, his mom gave us snacks, and we met his mom, and I forget who else was there, but other members of his family, and hung out for about an hour. And, I mean, it was really cool because we just got to be just somebody in the city, you know, just seeing the city. And this guy was just very nice to us, and you know, he just did exactly what he said he was going to do. He took us around and brought us back.
Yeah, that is really cool.
So we weren't going to waste that day just because we didn't get to go to the closing ceremonies.
Yeah.
You know, we were just like, okay, let's turn this lemon into lemonade here. And so we were just brainstorming, and that's what we came up with. So that's what we did.
Yeah, that's awesome. What did you do right after you got back from the games, and what was your homecoming reception like?
That was pretty cool. There were a lot of people from when we landed in L.A. I think we had a direct flight back to L.A., so I don't think we had to go back to Denver and then split up or anything. I think we had a direct flight back. So when we got to L.A., there were a lot of people from our gymnastics club at the airport there to meet us. And then, you know, I mean, it was crowded. And there were other athletes on our flight, so they had people meeting them, too. And that was very cool. And then after we'd been home a few days, our gymnastic club held a big reception for us. And there were a couple of city officials there and, you know, just people congratulating us. And they had several awards to give us. And one special thing that I thought was really cool, well, they had two things. They had made scrapbooks for each of us, for Kathy and for me. They had hired an artist to mold and cast a plaster replica of the Mexican peso that was issued for the Olympics. And so when he made it, he made one for me, one for Kathy, and one for my coach, and then he destroyed the mold. So there were only three made, and I still have mine. I'm looking right at it right now. It's sitting in my living room. And I've kept it all this time, and it's, you know, it's made of plaster, so if you drop it or anything, it's going to just shatter, but I've been really careful with it. So it's very cool because it looks just like the Mexican peso.
Yeah, that is really cool.
You know, because it says in Spanish, it says the games of the Olympiad, Mexico, 1968. And it's got the Aztec figure that was on the peso that year. And it's got the Olympic rings on it, too. So that was a very, very cool gift, I thought.
Yeah, absolutely. So you talked a little bit about your transition away from gymnastics, elite gymnastics and competition. What did you do right after you left the sport?
I was in college at the time, and a couple of friends that I grew up with in L.A., who were not really associated with my competition, did gymnastics in high school. And one of them was my best friend's brother, and he was a year or two older than us. But he and I decided that we would try to start our own, you know, gymnastic classes. And we met another girl who was also interested in doing that, who lived in a neighboring city. And so the three of us went to the community college that he and I attended, and we asked if they would consider letting us start a recreational program similar to how I got started, but doing it at the community college, you know, for kids to come in. And they said yes. And so we started the same kind of thing that I had gone to when I was young. And we just opened up some gymnastic classes. And I didn't have a whole lot of experience. I had taught a few classes, but he hadn't. And the other girl had taught a little bit too, but we just put our heads together and organized it, and from that, we did the same thing that Bud Marquette had done with us, and we we chose a few girls from that group and found out how to get them in some competitions and started working with them on their skills and their routines and started a girls' team. And after doing that at the college for a year or so, we decided, hey, you know, why don't we expand this and start our own gymnastics school? So the three of us, you know, pulled our money together and rented a warehouse and scratched and begged and built all the equipment we could put together to, you know, furnish a gym. And we started teaching classes and training our team, and it kept expanding. And I actually ended up marrying that guy, and we had the gymnastics school for 10 years. And it's not, in those days, it was real hard to make any money doing it. If you just paid your bills, you were probably doing really well. The overhead for a gym is just unreal, you know, with the cost of the building mostly, you know, because you need so much space and you need so many sets of the equipment to be able to run enough classes and you know, provide for a team to, mm-hmm. to work out. So, but it was a very interesting experience. None of us had any business experience prior to that, but we were ready to go for it, so we just did. And it was fun. The team did well. They competed, like I said, for 10 years. And I had a couple of girls compete internationally in junior Olympic type competitions. I was even asked during that time to take a squad of kids back to the same kind of competition I started in down in Mexico. So I took a squad of kids down to Mexico and competed in a junior Olympic competition, and they did well, and it was fun.
Mm-hmm.
I eventually, my husband and I decided to leave that gymnastics school. His brother, who had done gymnastics, and his dad, they were going to take it over and run it for a while with no competition team, but just classes. And my husband and I moved to San Diego because he got another coaching job where he wasn't the owner operator of the business, but just a paid employee.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we got down to San Diego, we actually ended up coaching with the Aztec Gymnastic Club for 3 years as employees for them, and I taught a few college classes at San Diego State University, teaching gymnastics there too.
Cool.
And so I coached and taught gymnastics after my competition career for like 13 years. So basically I spent like 25, 26 years in the sport active, either as a athlete or a coach, you know.
Yeah.
And a lot of people have done that, so... Mm-hmm. It kind of grabs you and keeps you for a long time.
yeah, for sure. Well, are you involved today in any way?
In the sport?
Yes.
No. Although, indirectly, I'd say I still am. Because I still work with kids. Sorry.
No worries.
I still work with kids. I teach elementary school.
Yes, Tom had mentioned that before. That sounds wonderful.
Yeah, I've been teaching for 18 years now.
Oh, wow.
So, a lot of the things, sorry.
No worries.
My main goal with my students is things that I've brought with me from sports. I teach them that They should just be good, honest, hardworking people to get the rewards that they want in life. And, you know, I look at kids today, and they, and I guess maybe kids have always been this way, especially when they're young, but I think even more today, kids kind of focus on materialistic things a lot. And I'm not all kids, obviously, but there's a lot of that going on. And I think parents are just so busy these days. They don't have the time to take with their kids to, like, show them the simple things in life and how, you know, how valuable those can be. But that's what I teach my kids, what I really, like, want my kids to take from my class is that they come in being one person and they leave being a better person.
I'm sure they will if they have you as a teacher.
So what were you going to ask me?
What has been the impact of being an Olympian on your life?
Wow. I guess mostly just to be humble, you know, to, I already knew the value of hard work because my dad was like that. That he taught us that, me and my brother. But I guess to just be humble about who you are and just be the best person that you can be is kind of funny because I remember when my coach sat some of us kids down and explained that the Olympics were coming up and, you know, we were young. We were like 12, 13, you know, we were just doing gymnastics because we loved it, you know, and it was fun and we got to travel to places to go compete. And, you know, and when my coach sat us down and talked to us about the Olympics coming, he said, so if some of you are interested in, you know, considering, you know, possibly trying out for the Olympics or even seeing if you're ready for it, he goes, I can find out what we have to know, what you have to learn, how, you know, how we go about qualifying you to get there. And he said, so, I mean, it sounds kind of funny, but he said, so raise your hand if you think you want to do this. And we're all sitting on the floor looking up at him, and we kind of looked at each other, and so then we all raised our hand. And we were like, all right, you know, okay, we'll do that, you know. It was kind of like we were like really, what's the word? I don't want to say ignorant, but we were just like oblivious to what it really meant, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember we were talking about it afterwards and we were like, so what do you think we're going to have to do? And so then when he finally, you know, came with information for us and he said, well, you have to learn these compulsory routines and then you have to learn some better skills in your optional routines and we have to get you in competitions where you're going to have a chance to actually try to qualify. And this was like a couple of years before the Olympics, you know, and we just said, all right, we'll try, you know, and so we just got to work. And we really had no clue if any of us were even going to be close to making it. But the more we worked at it and the more we saw what other people were doing, the more we realized, you know what, we actually have a little bit of a chance here. So let's work even harder, you know. So I think that was just something that stuck with me. It is like, you know, if you are interested in something, if you have a passion for something, that you put your whole self into it and you stick with it and you become a, like someone who studies as many aspects of it as you can. Mm. And, you know, you master your craft, so to speak. And it becomes the focus of your life without you even really knowing it sometimes. And, you know, gymnastics was that. Teaching is that now. Mm. And I took it from gymnastics and now I use it in the classroom with all the kids that I've ever taught in all these 18 years, you know. Mm. So, it's just important to keep a perspective of yourself as you're doing that, because you're human. You're not a robot. You are going to make mistakes, but when you succeed at something, you also need to know that you're still only human. And even though you succeeded at one thing, like a sport, it doesn't mean that you're better than anybody else or a superhuman or that you are never going to make mistakes. There are other aspects of your life where you are going to still make mistakes. And ask me to do a backflip right now, there's no way. I couldn't even do the splits, you know. So I don't know. I don't know if that made sense, but that's kind of what it became part of me.
Sure. Wendy, what one piece of advice would you give to today's Olympic hopefuls?
Ah, you know what? I saw that on the list, and I don't even remember what I was doing when I thought of this, but let me find it, because I wrote this down. Hold on.
Okay.
Ah, okay. So this is what I would say, and this goes for any sport. Enjoy the ride. Do what you know you can do and what you've trained to do and stay focused. Be thankful for being blessed with your physical ability and fitness. Be grateful for the opportunity to represent your country in an international and peaceful way. Be humble about your accomplishments, and your success will come back to you in very unexpected and pleasant ways. That's what I kind of live by.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's great. Thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome.
That's awesome. Well, is there anything else that you would like to tell us about before we close the recording?
Not on the record.
Okay.
No. There was there's a lot of stuff I could tell you off the record, but I'm not going to say those things. There's one thing that it was talking about, the legacy of the 68 team.
Yes.
That, if I'm correct, that was the first televised Olympics. So I think that's a big part of our legacy.
For sure.
That, you know, it changed how people related to the Olympics. It brought it into their living rooms, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because the U.S. in a lot of sports did extremely well in that Olympics, I think that really added momentum to the Olympic movement in our country. And I think that's pretty cool.